Well, for the first time in a couple weeks, it's just Dan and I. I hope that's not a disappointment, because the guests that we've had over the past few weeks have been phenomenal. To all of those folks, thank you for drastically improving the quality of the podcast. Kyson was great last week. We've had so many other good folks. So, thanks so much to all those people.
It did make me realize that this podcast would be so much better if it weren't you and I doing it.
Yeah, but, well, lots of things in life are like that. But I'm excited to be back. This one sounds interesting. We were talking, and the main deep dive we're going to go into today, you were kind of saying, is interesting, but maybe not super critical for a lot of writers. But this is one you've been chewing on for a minute. This has kind of been like your back burner one for like months now, right?
Yeah, I've been working on this one, thinking about this one for a long time. I think it's one that a lot of people think is more important than it actually is. I'm excited to get into that.
Very well researched, maybe not super impactful for everybody, but not that the others aren't well researched, Dan, but... that should be good. Not a ton of bike world news this week. The Brazilian World Cups are over. Cool to see America making such an impact. Cool to see Simon Andreassen get a World Cup win. He's been one of my favorites forever. And Jenny Rizved's coming back. So all this stuff in Brazil is great. Other than that, like the Giro's coming up, and it's going to be the Pogacar show. We saw the Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It was like the most boring race ever because Pogacar just showed up and was just on a different planet from everybody else. Interesting to see if anybody can make a dent at the Giro. I don't tend to think so, but we'll be talking about his attempt at the Giro Tour double and stuff in a little more depth. Local news wise.
So not a whole lot other than, well, a couple of things. We had a few of our riders out at the Whiskey 50.
Super cool event.
Yeah, super cool event. In fact, I was thinking about it. You know, in the future, I might consider like maybe trying to get more people out to these type the Epic Series rather than some of the national races.
Oh, yeah.
Just because they're like closer, there's less red tape. And I think it would be fun to do a different style of racing than Nika racing, you know, some more endurance. So that's something I'm kind of like considering next year.
For kids with pro ambitions, that kind of seems to be where the sponsorship dollars are going too.
I think
like
so.
The most successful domestic racers are, they're at these kind of quote unquote alternative events that have kind of become the new mainstream.
And it just seems like there's just a better chance of success there because starting position isn't as critical because it's a longer race, more time to iron things out, iron out a bad starting position. So that's something I'm kind of tossing around in my head about, Maybird moving forward. But we had Xander out there and Nate Jensen, and those are the two I know of there. But I think that's super cool. They were out there and tough race. I know Nate said he had a really good race. Xander got a flat, fixed it, finished. Did some time trialing. So, glad those guys were out there. That's super awesome. Yesterday, had a big epicish ride planned. It rained all day Friday. Super rainy Saturday.
Kind of unusual Utah weather. It was almost really, like just consistent rain for 2 days.
Really, really wet. And but I was surprised at how many of our riders got out there and rode. Like, and we even had some do some pretty big rides. Like I noticed like Ella Balls did a big, huge ride with her dad. And, I know Samson Richardson did a big ride in the rain. And, I actually got out and did a big ride, and I'm like, okay, it's raining now, but it's going to clear up. So I started riding. It didn't clear up the entire time. I was soaked. I was freezing cold.
Quick gear PSA. Not all warm clothing keeps you dry. Here in Utah, we mostly have dry cold that people ride in. So like your fleece jacket is going to work against you in the rain. Don't wear it on a rainy ride. Like rain gear, I don't even invest in because I have a Zwift membership. Because we just don't have that much like rainy riding here in the U.S., if you live in the UK or in the Pacific Northwest, I think like rain riding's it's a thing unto itself. But yeah, here, be careful when you're doing that. You can.
And I would have the whole time I was just thinking how much I wish I could have been riding my kicker, but,
your kicker kicked the bucket.
Yeah, it did.
Obviously not sponsored by Wahoo.
They're replacing it.
They stepped up, which is cool.
And I kind of didn't even expect him to. I just like emailed customer service and was kind of asking.
Well, I told you they were going to tell you to kick rocks. Yeah, I was like, I didn't think they'd do anything for you.
But they're sending me a refurbished one.
That's cool.
They probably have no idea how many hours I've put on that thing.
I will say, I still recommend Wahoo Train. And again, obviously not sponsored, but like I still recommend Wahoo products over other trainers because I think trainers in general are unreliable. Like as long as I've worked in the industry, there have been just like trainers get returned all the time and Wahoo seem to do that least. So I'm glad they're stepping up and helping you.
So the whole time I was riding, I was just kind of wishing I was in Watopia, but I was out in the rain riding, which is usually out of character for me because I do like the train. I don't like getting cold.
Yeah, you're like the king of the trainer nerds.
But I did have something kind of embarrassing happening to me. Happened to me during the ride. So I rode the Jordan River Parkway. I was heading south.
Okay.
And then I swear I got off the Jordan River Parkway.
Yeah.
And headed left. And I thought I was going east.
Yep.
And it was totally cloudy, totally rainy. I could barely see you know, a quarter mile ahead of me. And I kept riding what I thought was east, and traffic kept getting busier and busier. And I'm kind of like, I don't recognize this street, but I'm heading east. And then all of a sudden I got to like Bangor Highway. And I realized I was totally going the wrong way.
Generally, if you head east and hit Bangor Highway, you live inside the copper mine.
And I turned around and started heading the other way. And it was like the most misoriented I've ever felt. And I just kind of felt like, oh my goodness, does my family need to take away my keys? Am I...
Oh, well, that was like my deep dive for the episode is how to take away the keys to your bike. But yeah, no, the Jordan River part, it's kind of confusing. Like I almost always take a wrong turn when I ride it at some point.
Yeah. It's not super straightforward, but it's actually a lot of fun to ride.
Yeah.
I did notice there are more homeless people sleeping in the underpasses when it's raining. So that was a little bit interesting, but yeah, I love the Jordan River Trail. It was fun.
Yeah. Another interesting, we're talking about, this is actually kind of interesting and maybe relevant. Do you hear Stages is going under?
Oh, no, Stages really? Stages
just out of nowhere, just has laid off its entire workforce and they're going to, like, warranties are going to be handled by one of their retailers or something.
Oh, I love my Stages power meter.
Yeah, which is interesting because I hadn't heard it. Usually when bike companies go under, like when Niner declared bankruptcy a few years ago, like there had been rumbling, like, you know, like Scott's having the whole thing with its CEO and it's being bought by someone else or whatever. You hear, but Stage is just kind of out of nowhere, kind of doesn't exist anymore.
Aren't they just based out of Colorado?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
a bummer. And they've been around for a while. They're not like, oh, 3 years in, the project's failing. Like they've been around for a minute.
Does somebody else make a crank based power meter?
A few people, like 4i, I think is the big one now. Pioneer still does that, I think.
Okay.
So like other people do it and the product wasn't bad.
I love
it. It was the first like cheap power meter. So I think it kind of had a reputation for like, oh, well you never know if the numbers are real, but which I hated because like, I don't feel like mine ever, I've basically exclusively used Stages power meters and they've been fine. Like when I was in the industry, it was kind of hard for me to be like, oh, well you should spend all the money for the Quark or the SRM because it's technically better. But I'm like, I don't know. I use the Stages and it's fine. But yeah, that was interesting. And then Rafa is closing down its US office in Bentonville.
Oh
yeah. They seem to be having some financial trouble too. So
I thought Walmart owns them.
I think they own part of them or something, but I did see that they're closing their Bentonville office, which is interesting. So, yeah, post-COVID has been weird for the bike world. Some companies are killing it and others aren't. And a lot of people overproduced and made plans based on COVID era demand that they just thought would always exist, which is crazy to me. Like at Contender, we're having the big old sale yesterday. And everyone's like, why do you guys have so many bikes on sale? You know, 3 years ago, you walk out the door of a bike shop with a new bike, you're going to get knifed and someone's going to take it, right? Like people were paying over MSRP for bikes. And I think all of the suits at bike companies were like, oh, well, this is going to last forever. So let's just produce as much inventory as we possibly can. So like, you know, obviously biased, but like now's a decent time to be shopping for stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of deals going around right now. But yeah, so cool for Wahoo for taking care of you though. That's good.
Yeah, super cool. But I did. Yeah, it was a cold, wet ride. And I did realize that my gear wasn't rain gear. It was warm weather gear, but I was sopped and
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to drier, warmer days, but I love the spring. I guess, you know, there's like a lot of Round Valley's rideable now.
Quick note on that. I went out and rode today on Shoreline. A lot of Shoreline's dry. And a lot of Shoreline isn't dry. Like, I got up onto the bench. I wanted to climb Limekiln today, and like a lot of Shoreline's muddy. I did a lot
but
of walking
rain,
around mud.
Rain wetness dries out quickly.
That's kind of my thought too. I think we got enough though that like I probably shouldn't have ridden Shoreline. Yeah. Like, I only ride the dry stuff and then I'll walk on the side. Hikers, dude, are just tearing up the trails. The stereotype is like bikers go and tear up the trails. I was not seeing tire tracks. I was seeing boots. So this is a quick reminder for you guys and for other people. You know, like, hiking on muddy trails is bad too. Like, it's like, oh, you know, it's muddy. Like, we can't ride today. Let's go hike. Like, that damages the trail too. So don't do either of those things, because Shoreline was a mess today. And again, like, I didn't see a ton of bikers. Like, a lot of like the kind of Shoreline over by the U, or by like the, not the U, by the zoo and by This Is the Place and stuff was like totally fine. But like up through Dry Creek and stuff, and there was like a lot of stuff that I was walking around that just hikers were just tearing up. So a quick little reminder, don't ride muddy trails.
Yeah. Like, if the mud's sticking to your tires, it's too muddy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. You really shouldn't be making any marks. You know, if you occasionally hit a little area.
Yeah, because a lot of times it'll be dry in like, one section of the trail. There's like, a puddle,
there's like a 5-foot section. That, you know, that's one thing. But if it's like, you know, if it's like a 30-second section or a 2-minute section, that's you should have turned around. So
also bad on your bike. Like, you're going to accelerate your chain wear by like 10 times, you know, riding in the rain all the time. So, or, you know, getting muddy. So other than that.
Well, you know, I just want to go back to a little bit about a couple of our previous guests, about Gabe and Kyson. Like, it was just so cool being able to talk to those guys. So it was awesome to talk to Gabe, who, as you guys know, I just idolize Gabe. He is just an amazing athlete, amazing person. Now, one thing about his interview is he really didn't know what we were going to be talking about.
Yeah.
He was, you know, we really didn't prepare him very well.
Gabe just showed up and we lobbed questions at him, you know.
Which is kind of what I wanted, because I kind of wanted just to pick his brain and just kind of get his impulses on some of those topics. But the one takeaway I really got from him, and it was so simple, but I've been thinking a lot about it, is kind of when I asked him about, like, you know, what is it that makes the best athletes the best? And he just kind of pointed out, like, the importance of good old-fashioned hard work.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, like, out of all the topics we've talked about in this podcast and all the things we've harped on, that's just a concept that I've just kind of just neglected. You know, I've never really, and it's kind of so simple and obvious, but it's so true, you know, that it's not genetics. It's not, well, I mean, it is a little bit, but it's a lot of it just comes down to being willing to work hard, you know, and kind of put your heart and soul into it. I just thought that was just a super, I mean, there were a lot of good takeaways, but that was kind of my takeaway from that. And then talking with Kyson was just a lot of fun. You know, we're both kind of training nerds. He really knows his stuff, and he was real easy to talk to. And it was nice because he actually came to our house and we did it in person, which I don't like doing things over Zoom.
Yeah, the Zoom, there's just no great way to like make a Zoom interview sound great, you know, like unless both people have good recording equipment on both sides.
And honestly, I hate doing Zoom. Like, I was like less nervous when we did the live Maybird opening meeting than I am when we like are doing a Zoom meeting. I just don't, I'm just not comfortable on Zoom for some reason, but, it was so awesome having Kyson there. And we talked about just like literally one of my favorite topics. You know, he kind of talked about, we talked about a few things, but I think one of my big takeaways was just, we kind of talked about like doing zone two right. And obviously the tendency is for most people to do zone two too hard, you know, And, you know, I have people all the time requesting to be in a harder Maybird group because their group rides aren't hard enough. I'm like, yeah, they're probably just about right. You know, you're just not really understanding the goal there. But since that, there's a couple thoughts I had that, I actually kind of wish Kyson was here. No offense, Joe.
I mean,
cause he'd be more,
Kyson's a great substitute for me in like basically every situation. I'll try to think of one where I'm better than Kyson, maybe an eating contest.
I know. Like what if Kyson and Gabe did a podcast? We'd just be like,
oh, we'd be out of business, man. That's why we pay them not to. They get like a little kickback from us every week. They don't start their own podcast.
Yeah, so there's just a couple things I kind of thought about after that would have been, I kind of wish we would have brought up during that. Mm. And the first one was like, you know, if you're a rider that's only doing your group rides, only riding a couple times a week, I don't think it's as critical that you absolutely stay in zone two on those because that's the only riding you're doing.
Yeah. You don't have enough volume that like,
yeah, I think
just take what you can get. Right.
I think being really, really strict on that, really applies to people that are training more consistently, you know, like 4 or 5 times a week and so forth.
Cause if you're doing 4 or 5, you know, 2-3 hour rides a week, they can't all be just, you know, balls out, like going super crazy hard. But yeah, like if you're a parent listening to this and your kid's like, going to, you know, averaging 1.5 Maybird rides a week, like
just go out and have fun.
Just go out and have fun. Yeah. Like don't sweat that.
Yeah. But I do think it was a super important topic to be brought up because it seems like intensity is kind of exploited amongst youth athletes because mm-hmm. they're so good at it.
Right. Yeah.
And they like doing it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I do think that, and it's getting less and less so, but I think there used to kind of be a tendency to just, like for Nike coaches just to have kids do too much intensity because you can see results.
Yeah. It's the get rich quick scheme of cycling. Right.
Yeah. You know, and so I think that's just a super important principle to bring up, but I think just the principle that I think we really need to remember is that, you know, if you're training consistently, you know, 5 days a week, 2 and occasionally 3 of those days, you can go harder than zone two, but the rest and the majority should be at an aerobic pace, you know? And if you just kind of keep those guidelines in mind, you're fine. You mm-hmm. know, if you're trying to go hard every single time you hop on a bike and that ends up being 4 or 5 times a week, that's when you start getting into trouble. And the reason I'm kind of bringing this up is I was aware of a kid that actually wanted to be moved into another group because his, you know, his Maybird rides were above zone two.
This is the less common complaint.
I know. I don't get this complaint very often at all. And so it kind of made me think about, you know, like, I know there's a few kids out there that have coaches and are following training plans and are trying to do things right. And that's awesome. And that's good. But I think it's okay if occasionally some of your training's messy and some of your training's clean. And I think you need to have a little bit of both.
Cause we talk about like the science on here as best we can of like, this is the ideal. Right. And I think this kind of applies to nutrition too, where like, truly, the ideal nutrition might be for you to have a protein-based paste with the exact perfect amount of nutrients and calories in it, and you go on your way, right? But like the real world's messy, and it's good to like know the science and know what the ideal is. But like on your birthday, you should have some birthday cake, even if that is not optimal, right? Like if you're having a bad day, treat yourself to a Starbucks, even if that's not optimal, right? And I think training's kind of the same. Where like do you want optimal training? Trainer in your basement, like do the optimal training in your basement. Like, I tried for a while to kind of make my group ride zone two, but then the reality is like, if there's more than 4 kids in the group, maybe even less, like not everybody's having the same intensity. You know, the reality is for me as a coach, I have kids show up who are wildly different in terms of their ability and background and fitness at that particular point in the season. And for parents listening to this, I'll come down harder on parents if this is your mentality. Like, your kid's not an Olympic athlete. Like, there are no Olympic athletes on Mayberry right now. I'll let you know when there are. That'd be super cool. But I, like, your kid shouldn't be training to the clinical optimal, you know, like, they're not a lab rat. They're a child. And even when they're not, like, I'm not a child anymore. It wouldn't be good for me to try to train that way. You know, like, riding bikes, obviously, like, there's a happy medium where you understand the principles and your rides are intelligent and the way that you're putting it together works. But, like, if you have the opportunity to ride, like, we have some amazing coaches on Maybird who will take you to some incredible places and teach you just good skills. The overarching goal is always longevity and what is good for the kid. And if you could make an argument to me that, like, cycling period is just not good for a kid right now, I would say don't cycle. Like, the emphasis is what is good for the kid. And I think it's generally really intelligent, nuanced training that leads them to ride bikes for the next several decades. So go to your group rides, even if they aren't optimal, because they're great.
Yeah, and they'll still make you faster.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, that's... And you know, I could sit and debate whether, like, a 30 by 30 workout is better than a sweet spot workout is better, how it compares to a hard group ride. And I honestly think that if you did, like, a clinical trial in a lab comparing those three workouts, they could not determine which one is more beneficial.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like I say, there's lots of ways to get fast. And I think what we're kind of trying to get at is, like, you know, if your group ride does put you over your zone two, that's not the end of the world. That's fine. But I only really think you need to do, like, one a week, you know.
Yeah, that's
two
true.
Two is better, you know, for most kids.
Yeah.
But if you're following, like, a strict structured training plan, your coach should be able to figure out how to allow you to do one a week, because honestly, like, and especially the bigger the coaching service, like, I know that, like, if you're being coached by, like, Kyson or Gabe, it's very individualized. I know that they look at things, they put a lot of things into it, but some of the bigger, more established coaching services, you're basically training off a plan that was adapted for somebody totally different than you. And they've just made a few modifications, copying things, pasting things.
But it's even an algorithm a lot now.
It's like, not as, know. It's not as individualized as you might think. You know,
it's not a bad thing. I think there's value in it if you decide that's good for you, but, like, like, a good coach will never tell you, like, this is not optimal, don't do this, you know, because a lot of what you guys do isn't optimal, you know, like, and if you're, like, if your goal is to be a professional cyclist, my advice is don't. Like, that is a bad career choice. If it's right for you, it'll kind of happen, I think.
Yeah, for parents, again, kids, for the principle is two, maybe three above threshold workouts a week, and at most... And if your group ride happens to be above your zone two, just count that as one of your hard workouts.
Yeah.
And you're still going to get faster. You're still going to have fun. You're going to have it. And I think you're just trading something way more important for something way less important.
If your coach is telling you never to go to, like, group rides, like, find a new coach or use that money to buy a new car. Like, you know, I just, like, that's not valuable, realistic. I really don't care if you land on the top of every single podium for 18 months, if you drop your bike after, and I can't even count how many kids I've seen do that. So,
yeah. You know, and like I say, it's okay if some of your training's really, really clean and precise. Like, I like to ride the trainer during the winter.
Yeah.
It's very clean, very precise. Group rides, midweek races, that's messy training, but it's also very, very valuable.
Yeah. And again, like with the nutrition thing, 90% of the time you should be nailing it on your nutrition and eating lots of vegetables and stuff. But, you know, like, sometimes the 2 a.m. Taco Bell run's an important, like, thing for you to do in your life with your friends. So not optimal, but, and don't, like, freak out when this stuff happens. I remember freaking out so much when, like, my training nutrition wasn't optimal as, like, a 17-year-old, and that's ridiculous. Like, don't live like that.
Yeah. So I think really kind of, like, so we've given the principle.
Yeah.
Just that principle is a good guiding principle. I think what really does matter isn't exactly what particular workout was prescribed that day. What I think really, really matters is, well, first of all, your consistency, and then just how hard you work. You know, kind of like Gabe said, you know, like, you could have, like, the most perfect set of intervals prescribed by Jim Miller himself. And if you do them like crap and don't put your heart into them, they're not going to benefit you, you know. But if you have some mediocre intervals planned by someone that doesn't know what they're doing like me, but you put your heart and soul into them, they're going to make a difference. They're going to matter, you know. And then, yeah, so, that's just hopefully.
Yeah, just know. Something to chew on. Something to chew on, I think.
Go to group rides, have fun, do some midweek races.
Yeah, have fun doing this, man. Why on earth would you do such a painful, expensive, time-consuming sport if you weren't having fun?
Yeah.
Yeah, rethink your life choices if you're doing this and not having fun. Move on to the deep dive?
Yeah, let's do the deep dive.
So, teased a little bit. I'll find some clever pun to maybe kind of preview it in the title, but what's the deep dive for today?
Okay, so as Joe mentioned earlier, this is something I've been thinking about for a long time, for somewhat selfish reasons. I think, like I said, this is something that a lot of coaches oversimplify and maybe
overemphasize.
And a lot of people think this is really, really important. And
it isn't necessarily.
At least it's not something that you really need to stress about too much. But it can also be very beneficial to understand. So, today we're going to talk about, and we've talked about all of this stuff a little bit before, but today we're talking about cadence. And
cadence is really, because it's one of like the, it's like on your first ever Cat Eye Bike computer from like, you know, 2004, it'll record like three things, and cadence is one of them. Like cadence is something that like is always there. And I think a lot of people emphasize, like, because we have people come in the shop all the time, like, oh, my cadence sensor fell off. And I'm like, you look at your cadence? Like, I don't know. But maybe I should, right? Like, I think a lot of people in this think about it way too much. And then people like me should maybe start thinking about it a little bit. Why did you start chewing on this, other than you being a nerd who needs a better hobby?
Okay, well, there is a little story. First off, let me point out this podcast could be extremely short. But we're not going to let it be.
So. Yeah. Like, hey, everybody, it's another great week to ride your bike. Don't be a douchebag and ride in zone two. All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week. You
know, like. No, but so it's actually on True Grit. You know, I did True Grit. I kind of decided last minute I was going to do it. I was feeling pretty good, having a lot of fun. Kind of going like harder than I was planning on going, just really, really, it seemed like the race was going well. All of a sudden I started to feel my cramps coming on in my legs. Like I started to feel some cramping, inner thighs, you know, which is race ending for me. So I kind of had to just back off my power quite a bit to prevent that from happening. And, you know, as I continued to ride, I kind of noticed that, like, if ever I, like, stood up or started to push really, really hard to go up a short little...
Because you got, like, zen in this race.
Yeah.
And the barrel roll stuff.
If I really kind of put, like, an unusually high amount of torque into my pedaling, I would start to get cramping symptoms again. And so I have to, and eventually throughout the race, I kind of started to realize, you know, if I just kept my cadence higher and my torque lower, I got to a point where the cramping kind of just went away, and I was able to finish the race decently. I could have done better, you know, but decently without cramping, you know? And so I'm like, is there a relationship between cadence and cramping? And, you know, I did a little research on that. There was nothing out there that really kind of compared cramping to cadence. And, you know, there was really nothing on that, you know? So I had to do a lot of digging in.
Cause again, like sports science in this field is like basically non-existent. Like there's very few like real science studies about any given topic, let alone something kind of left field like this, right?
Well, and there's actually a lot, and we'll talk about it, but there's actually been a lot of studies on cadence, you know, fairly weak studies, I would suggest, but, and there's a lot of fads and different trends with cadence, but yeah, this, you know, there's kind of like, I mean, is there an optimal cadence? You know, I've heard some people just throw out some number like it's 80 or it's 90, and it's not that simple. You know,
yeah, I can say it's not 40 and it's not 130.
Exactly. You
know? And this is because I think this is one of the things that's really changed a lot in the past few years, even in the grand scheme of cycling, going back to like Pantani or something in the 90s, like drivetrain technology has changed so much in the last 10 or 15 years, in the last 5 years even, that like we ride at much higher cadences than we used to.
We do.
Like, go back and watch like footage from, you know, like Pantani or Indurain, like those guys climbing the mountains. I mean, you know, like they had what, like 8 speeds out back, and they just didn't have the rate. And so those guys are doing like 35 RPM standing for like an hour, you know? Mm-hmm. And like you watch pro cycling now, that doesn't happen anymore because we've got, you know, like 12 speed drivetrains that have huge amounts of range. So you can have a ridiculous sprint gear and a gear that's way easier to climb with than you had back in the 90s and 2000s, let alone like the 50s and 60s when those guys, like, they just like, you couldn't climb a lot of hills because you didn't have the gears to, right?
And I think too, so it's partly equipment. It's partly just kind of fad science too, that like, you know, before Lance Armstrong, the trend was like lower, slower
gearing. Again, kind of out of necessity.
But out of that might've been equipment related. And then, you know, Lance Armstrong was, you know, after he came back from cancer, had like a really, really high cadence, and Chris Froome had an insanely high cadence, and Team Sky kind of touted that that's more efficient. And, you know, if you listen to the latest Fast Talk, the guest on that is claiming that most pros spin too fast and they'd be more efficient if they slowed down their cadence, which is kind of based on studies that weren't on pro cyclists.
Yeah.
You know, and I think pro cyclists, again, are...
Any science being touted in the bike world is usually weak.
It's not the best. Science. I wouldn't say it's weak, but it's not the best.
Comparatively, in the grand scheme of how good science can be, it's like, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, and I know there's some coaches that might just throw out a number that like 90 RPMs, which it's not that simple.
Yeah.
And anyone that just throws out a number,
anybody who simplifies things that much is taking your money for something that sucks. Like,
yeah. So really, to kind of, to address this topic, and you got to remember my original question was, would a higher cadence prevent cramping?
You're not even talking about efficiency or what's fastest. You just want to eliminate a specific problem, right?
Yeah, but we will get into efficiency and so forth. But for me, it was like, you know, if I keep my cadence higher, is that going to prevent cramping? And so that was my question, which might not be super relevant to all of you, but I do think it brings up some important things. And so, before we get to that, we've just got to go through a whole lot of background on muscle fiber types.
Fast twitch, slow twitch?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is something we've talked about before. But so within a muscle, like within a given muscle, you've got several different motor units. And each of these motor units are controlled by a motor neuron. And
like you said that with a Midwest accent there, a motor neuron.
A motor neuron.
This is the Minnesota Cycling Podcast. Got your motor neurons, yeah, and then you've got your fast twitch and your slow twitch.
When that came out of my mouth, it sounded really weird.
Every it's time like, Dan does something like that, he just makes pleading eye contact with me for a second. Like, did he catch that? And sometimes I didn't, but the eye contact, I'm like, oh, wait, a motor. Oh, okay, yeah.
So
sorry.
So each motor neuron controls a given number of muscle fibers, and it could be just a few.
Neurons that is connecting to your brain, right?
Yeah, to your spinal cord.
Your brain is through your spinal cord sending signals to your muscles to do different stuff, to pick up a cup or push the elevator button.
Yeah, exactly.
Pedal a bike, right? Okay.
Yeah. And so each of these motor neurons is attached to a certain number of muscle fibers.
Right.
And this could be just a few muscle fibers, or it could be thousands of muscle fibers.
Right.
So there's different sizes of motor units.
I have a question really quick. Like, when you're eating chicken and it kind of comes apart in those little like strings a little bit, is that a muscle fiber or is that something else? Do you know what I'm talking about? How you can kind of like see like when you're eating a piece of meat that you've cooked.
Yeah.
Is that a muscle fiber?
Yeah, those are muscle fibers.
Is that a totally unrelated thing?
No, yeah, okay. You can actually see muscle fibers. Some are really small and
some are a little bigger.
Yeah. Okay. But
my intelligent contribution to this conversation. I was genuinely curious. Yes,
when you're eating chicken, that is muscle.
That's what you're saying. Well, no, but you're saying the.
I know. Okay. I know what you're saying.
Remember, don't mess with the guy who knows how to edit this, and you don't.
Okay. But yeah, so these motor units can either be really big or really small. Is kind of the point I'm getting. But they can also be primarily, these motor units can be like, and you've heard about fast twitch and slow twitch.
Right. Like fast twitch is you need to jump up onto the counter. Slow twitch is you're pedaling a bike up a hill for an hour, right?
And it used to kind of just be fast twitch and slow twitch because initially they kind of would dye the muscle fibers with chemicals and some turned out white and some turned out black. And so they kind of initially just identified two and then, you know, then they've been able to identify three. And then lately it's even getting broken down even more specifically into multiple.
Is it a spectrum?
It's more of a spectrum. Okay. And we'll kind of get into that. But, and calling them slow versus fast twitch, like initially when they noticed the difference between the different type of muscles, they noticed that some contracted faster than the others. And so they kind of call them slow and fast, which while they do contract slower versus faster, that's probably not the most important identifying characteristic. It's just kind of what they're called, you know? So,
I think you're throwing shade at scientists here.
This is just from a long, long time ago. That's just kind of what they first
science
observed.
Science gets better over time.
Right. You know, so really kind of calling in there's like the type 1 muscle fibers, which are the slow twitch, the type 2A muscle fibers, which are kind of the medium muscle type fibers. And then the type 2X, which are the fastest twitch.
It's giving Nika vibes now.
Wait, what?
Different. I was saying like Nika, where you've got like 10 different.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about those different type of muscle fibers in a second. But about these motor units, it's really recruiting motor units is super important to understand because like when you're recruiting a motor unit, it either turns on completely or off. Like you can't just kind of turn on a dimmer switch on one of the motor units. And how you produce more power is by recruiting more motor units.
So they kind of fire and it's you're firing more instead of firing harder.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Rob Pickles on Fast Talk gave like the best explanation of it I've ever heard. And I love this explanation. He was talking about like you have a like someone trying to push a car up a hill and they're not successful. So a bunch of people come to help push the car. You know, and if you get a bunch of enough people to come push that car, you can push the car up the hill.
Right.
You know, and so that's kind of how it works, you know, like the more force is demanded, the more motor units are utilized to do the task.
So your muscle's not pushing harder. It's pushing more kind of, I don't know.
Yeah. It's just recruiting more motor units to do something. And something really important to point out is how when your muscle's recruiting motor units, it always starts with the smallest motor units, which are incidentally also slow twitch or type 1 type fibers that are associated with that motor unit, recruits those first, and then it recruits the bigger ones as needed. But it always starts.
Makes sense because those are the ones that are getting used all the time that are more low intensity, long distance. Like you don't want to be firing the big gun. Like they're just not good at repetitive work. You can only do fast twitch stuff so much. There's like a short lifespan for that. Basically,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
You know, so like with that analogy of trying to push the car up the hill, like first it'll recruit like the slow twitch, the smallest muscle fibers first, but then to be able to push that car up the hill, it's gotta
go way up the chain to your everything, right?
Okay. But it starts with the smaller motor units and goes to the larger units. And even when the larger units are recruited, the smaller motor units stay recruited still. So like if you're doing a bench press, you're using really large motor units, but you're still using those really small ones as well.
So would it be accurate to say that if your fast twitch muscles are being recruited, your slow twitch muscles are also being recruited?
Yes.
But that if your slow twitch muscles are being recruited, your fast twitch aren't necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally.
Okay. I have another question. I hope I'm not jumping forward too much here. Just thinking about, like, you're pedaling up a hill at 50 RPM versus 100, right? Producing the same power, going the same speed. Now that we know that principle that, like, you're not firing your muscles harder, you're just recruiting more muscle units, that will change, right? Because there's less torque when you're spinning faster. So is that part of the efficiency debate that you're like, you're recruiting fast twitch muscles more at lower RPMs? Is that part of where we're going with this?
That's exactly where we're going with this whole thing.
Did I just have an intelligent thought for the first time in like weeks?
Yeah, I mean, that's like basically where this whole thing is leading.
Did I, if I can, I can cut it out if that ruined it.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, one thing that is kind of funny is like there are a few people that kind of make the misconception that like you use fast twitch muscles at higher cadences because it's faster. But really, the contraction speed of the fast versus slow is just one of the aspects of these muscle fibers. You know, they're both so fast that.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That either one could spin at 120 RPM. They're,
right.
You know, that's right. Not the limiter there. But it is more about the force. So let's talk about the different types of muscle fibers. So first we've got the slow twitch, but we're going to call them type 1 muscle fibers. These fibers, they're the smallest fibers. They have lots of capillaries in them. They have
tiny little blood vessels.
Tiny
right?
little blood vessels.
The smallest? Isn't that the smallest unit of blood cell? Is a capillary? Okay.
They have lots of myoglobin in them, which is like basically a protein that holds oxygen.
Okay.
This is basically the dark meat.
Okay.
You know, and that's the reason, because it has all the capillaries and all the myoglobin and blood vessels. And basically these muscles are
a little macabre, but that's a good way to, I mean, yeah, like we've all eaten a chicken, right?
Yeah.
Okay. These are the muscles that taste a little better, but they're not quite as good.
They're more gamey, I think.
Yeah. I found that too. Yeah.
So, these muscles are basically designed for aerobic cellular respiration.
Okay.
So, lots of mitochondria. These muscles are designed to use fat as fuel. There's not as much glycogen stored in these muscles as there are other types of muscles. It's more like triglycerides are used to create the power from the fat, or to store the fat as power. But they're also like when a muscle contracts, it's basically actin and myosin kind of pulling against each other, almost like someone climbing a rope. And there's less of the myosin enzyme activity, which is the reason for the slower contractions, but it's also part of the reason that they fatigue less. And these type of muscles can, like some of these muscles, like your heart is kind of like an example of a slow twitch, a type 1 muscle.
It's the type 1S, right?
Like yeah, and that's why it's so red.
Continuously as long as you're alive.
Yeah, and also a lot of the muscles that help us stand up and stay upright are very type 1. They're very fatigue resistant. These muscles can basically just go and go and go without getting fatigued.
Mm.
With very little fatigue.
Right.
Obviously super useful in the sport that we've chosen. So that's the first type, type 1. Then you've got a type 2A. And these muscles, they're very large fibers actually. But they also have capillaries, they have mitochondria. These muscles start to store a lot of glycogen. But the cool thing about these type of fibers is they can act either completely aerobic or they can be glycolytic. So they're really kind of just known as almost like a hybrid type muscle fiber.
Okay.
So the myosin enzyme activity is greater, so they do contract faster and with more force. But that these type of muscles are good at producing kind of a moderate amount of force with a moderate amount of fatigue.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the type 2A and honestly, very, very useful in cross-country mountain biking.
Right. Yeah.
So third type of muscle fiber is the type 2X muscle fiber, which this is the white meat.
Okay.
It has almost no capillaries and almost no myoglobin, very little mitochondria in its cells. These muscles store lots of glycogen, and these muscles do not work aerobically. They produce power like glycolytically, which is where a lot of lactate's produced, that's where lactate is produced is a byproduct. And also kind of like the creatine kinase type efforts are produced. And that's where like for the sudden, like standing long jumps or dunking a basketball or punching something, you know, just the super, super short, fast movements. These are the type of muscles we use. But the point is they're just not aerobic at all. Super high force, but super quick fatigue.
Okay.
You know, like when you're bench pressing, how long can you bench press before you're tired?
I mean, it's a handful of reps basically, right?
Yeah.
You couldn't do it for an hour.
Yeah. And as we mentioned before, these are the type of muscles that are recruited absolutely last. So like with type 1 muscles, they're very distinctive. The type 2A muscles are very distinctive, but a pure 2X muscle is actually kind of rare. And this is something that they're just kind of finding now as they're able to have more sophisticated means of identifying muscle fiber types, is that there's between type 2A and type 2X, there's a whole bunch of different gradients of muscles that, you know, that become gradually kind of more aerobic and have more capillaries and so forth. There's just kind of a gradient between the type 2As and the type 2X. But the thing that's super important to point out here is that these muscle fibers are very, very plastic. They're very able to change and adapt according to the demands we place on them repeatedly.
Because you've said before that one of your goals in training is to have a higher distribution of slow twitch muscle fibers, correct?
For our sport, that's very beneficial. So genetics kind of gives us a starting point, but the type of sports we choose to do, the type of activities we choose to do really kind of will really shift our muscle fibers in one direction or the other based on what we do. You know, like if you decide to do Ironmans and train for that, that's going to do one thing to your muscle fibers. If you decide to be a power lifter.
If this was the Maybird Lifting Podcast, we'd have a different agenda.
Huh? You know, which is that's a really good thing to point out, because most of the muscle physiology videos you're going to watch on like YouTube,
yeah,
or are going to have completely different goals
than
we do.
Fortunately, the kind of YouTube ad bro influencers haven't discovered cycling yet. So like, you know, a lot of that content you can just stay away from.
Yeah. Like for strength training, the type of strength training you prescribe for an endurance athlete and a cyclist.
Oh, it would be the worst for a powerlifter.
The purpose of that is really to teach your body how to recruit more motor units at one time. So it's more of a neurological thing that it's training, not so much like a muscle growth
Ooh, we're keeping that. Stick the landing.
Hypertrophy. Okay. I hate saying that word.
Hypertrophy. Yeah, that doesn't roll off the tongue.
It doesn't roll off the tongue. So it just kind of has some different goals. But generally, the training that we're doing is trying to shift our muscles, our type 2X muscles to a type 2A muscle, and our 2A muscles to a type 1 muscle. Generally, we're trying to shift our muscles to a slower twitch muscle, which not that it's not because it's a slower twitch, just because it's more oxidative, because it's more in fatigue resistant. You know, if you can do more work with those type of muscles and then save your type 2A muscles for race winning type moves, you're going to become a better cyclist overall. So, and so basically all training that we do kind of moves us towards that direction. And I think that's the important point to bring out, is that these muscle fibers are trainable just based on the type of training that we do, you know, and like if we're strength athletes, we would be doing completely different things to get completely different results that wouldn't necessarily help us out as endurance athletes.
It's like, how close do people get to being like a completely fast twitch athlete or a completely slow twitch athlete?
Well, that's a really interesting question. First of all, we really don't know completely, because right now, like if you take a muscle biopsy, you're just kind of taking a snapshot of one particular muscle. And
that's what I think every time I do a muscle biopsy. And then they wake up and they're like, how did you get my house? And I'm like, I'm going to run. And yeah.
But we're really not like going to be like a pure fast twitch athlete or a pure slow twitch athlete. But some people have a higher ratio than other people, and you know, your training is going to shift that higher one way or the other. I honestly think that like for instance, an athlete that is really good at endurance has really kind of developed their type 1 muscles, they're still going to have a good amount of type 2A muscles that they can use to help win races and, you know, during the critical parts of a race. So we still have a mixture of them. It's just that our training kind of shifts us from one side of the ratio to the other, basically. But it's still a good mixture no matter what type of athlete you are. So all of that background kind of brings us into the cadence discussion, which
50 minutes into the episode, let's finally answer the question.
So we mentioned earlier that there's kind of been like the trend in cadence kind of shifts from being slow to fast to slow to fast, and it's going back to slow again a little bit. But let's just talk about a little bit about cadence. So cadence basically, I guess our power is kind of determined by our torque and our RPMs. And torque is kind of the rotational equivalent of force. And the RPMs is how fast we're spinning. And it's up to us to kind of come up with the optimal combination of these two things for our circumstances. And I kind of compare it to like when you're mixing like scratch or something in your bottle. You know, if you put too much of the scratch powder in, it tastes kind of icky. If you don't put enough in, you can't taste it at all. You know, you kind of have to just put the right amount of powder.
Chocolate milk's a better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like with your Nesquik.
Yeah, okay, we'll do Nesquik. Yeah. So like if you put too much Nesquik powder
in. You just do a little bit. It's kind of weak sauce.
Yeah.
It's not that good. It's too much. It's kind of gross unless you're 5. You know, everybody made that one black cup of like chocolate milk one time and life only went downhill from there. But yeah, to your point, there's kind of a right amount, you know, or like with your cereal, how much milk you need, because you don't want like cereal soup, but then you also don't want like Chex Mix. You want like the perfect, should we do another tortured metaphor?
I think that's 3 tortured metaphors in one, but yeah, so
your fourth is free.
So really when you're trying to come up with the most efficient cadence, that's kind of what you're doing. You're kind of matching your, you know, how fast you're rotating the cranks to how much torque you're applying, you know, and really, you know, really it's almost kind of like based on perceived effort, you know, what is going to be most efficient.
Cause I find that, like, and I think a lot of people might find too, that like, if you've been riding for a while at one cadence, just switching to another kind of feels good. Like going and just sort of standing on the pedals and pushing really hard for a while feels, you know, doing 50 RPMs when you've been spinning forever kind of feels good sometimes, you know, or that if you've been, you know, pushing super hard, it's nice if you can like spin for a second and kind of, you know, and that's more just a feel thing. I don't know if there's any science behind that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, because it does feel good because you're kind of using different type of muscle groups and so forth. And
right.
And
giving the other ones a break for a sec.
But I think the really the important thing to remember about cadence is it's very individual. And that really depends on like your muscle fiber distribution, you know, like what type of muscle fiber distribution you have. That can be a big influence on it. Like someone that that's more, you know, more type 2 muscle dominant might do better at a lower cadence, and someone that's more type 1 muscle dominant would probably do better at a higher cadence.
There's a guy, Stéphane Tempier. Do you remember that name? He was the super skinny French guy, as if that narrows it down. He rode for Bianchi at the end of his career, and he was the guy who would just be like 30 RPMs, and he was always standing on the pedals, and he like looked kind of goofy, but he's like one extreme end of the spectrum, and then you've kind of got your Chris Froome on the other side, where it's like, you know, the head cocked to one side and the knees sticking out a bit, and you're doing 130 RPM and blowing up Contador on Alpe d'Huez, you know. So it is kind of like different. And those guys are both pros.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, another thing it depends on too is your pedaling technique.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like a lot of times beginners tend to kind of gravitate towards lower RPMs.
Because their pedaling technique
sucks. Yeah.
Yeah.
And pros tend to gravitate towards a little bit higher RPMs. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the 130 cadences, those are actually pretty rare.
Yeah.
Most pros are actually in the 80 to 90 range.
For most of them, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Which, is that on the road, you think?
Yeah.
I was like, I feel like in the mountain, it's probably less.
But yeah, so... But it also depends on how much power you're producing. So, like... If you're producing like, you know, if you're kind of in like your zone two, you know, a lower cadence, like around a 70 or 80 is probably more efficient than a higher cadence. But if you're at your power, like your VO2 max power, you know, like if you were to do a VO2 max test and whatever power was recorded when you're at your VO2 max, you know, if you're riding at that power, a higher cadence is going to be more efficient.
Right.
You know, and like an example of this would be like if you were just on like a, like on some rollers with no resistance whatsoever, which is going to be harder? Like, which is going to be more exhausting, riding at 10 RPM or 130?
130.
Yeah.
Hands down.
Yeah. Yeah. So at lower powers, lower RPMs are probably more efficient. At your VO2 max power, not only is the higher cadence probably more efficient, it's probably necessary to be able to produce that much power.
Because we throw out all the time that, like, I remember you saying one time that, like, Rattlesnake Gulch is a bad place to do intervals, or can be, because it's so steep that you kind of can't get power out.
Yeah.
If you're going to try to climb a tree on your bike, you couldn't get any power because it's too steep for you to.
You're putting down a ton of torque.
Because the equation for power is torque and cadence, basically. Right?
Yeah.
And so if either one of those go out the window, like if you're on, or like the better example is like a Wahoo kicker with no resistance, like an unplugged Wahoo kicker, you can't, it's impossible to put out power because there's nothing to push against, right?
Exactly.
And then if there's too much to push against and you can't turn the pedals over, there's no power either. So...
Yeah.
I didn't realize that for a long time, that's kind of like, learn some physics. If you're going to do this sport, just have a basic understanding of physics. Like that's, you know, take that class in high school. It's maybe harder than biology, or just take it though. I think as a cyclist is good for you.
Yeah. So if you're cruising around at zone two, you probably don't need to be doing 90 to 100 RPM. You're probably wasting some energy that way.
Yeah.
You know, 70 to 80 is probably fine for that. But if you're doing VO2 max intervals, you're going to want your RPMs to be around 90 probably.
Yeah.
So
if you're constantly kicking around at 40 or 140, like, you're wrong. In between, it's kind of, you know.
So there's also kind of a trade-off too here. And this is kind of why we went so into like the muscle physiology there, is like at a lower cadence, you're kind of paying the muscle fatigue cost. But at a higher cadence, it's more about the cardiovascular load.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so at a lower cadence, you're going to fatigue your muscles more. At a higher cadence, your heart rate's going to be higher.
Right.
And you got to find out where that trade-off is right. You know, and there's a point where it's kind of a sweet spot. Now, one thing to kind of throw out there, you know, like if you're riding up at like Winter Park, Colorado, where the elevation's really, really high, or Leadville, you might want to do a little bit lower cadence.
Yeah, there's less oxygen at your disposal, yeah. So the paying that price is going to be even more costly.
Yeah, it'll keep your respiration rate down a little bit and your heart rate down a little bit, you know. But spoiler alert, you know, like if you're a cramper like me, keeping the RPMs a little bit higher and having the muscular fatigue be less could help prevent cramping.
This is interesting that like at the beginning of this episode, I didn't think there was an obvious answer to the question, but now once you understand that, you're like, oh, well, duh, then like obviously higher cadence is going to be preferable for somebody who's cramp prone. Well, or is there an asterisk to that?
No, no, actually not. It's true because like also like your larger motor units with your type 2 X type muscles are the ones that are more likely to cramp.
Now, this is bad news for mountain bikers and cyclocrossers because there is some stuff where there's just you can't ride Zen at a super high cadence all the time. You know, like you can't get like in cross, like you can't always have like on the road, even climbing Little Cotton, there's gearing where you can just kind of have it. But
if you can get better at using your type 1 muscles mm-hmm. for the majority of the race and for the majority of the ride, when you've got to use the type 2As and the type 2Xs,
right,
they're not already fatigued. But if you're using those muscles on the first 80% of the ride and you get to the end of the ride where you really need to do something hard, if they're already fatigued, they're going to be more likely to cramp.
So the takeaway here is for those of you prone to cramping, you know, pull the low cadence lever judiciously.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's basically kind of,
why I'm here.
That's basically kind of the conclusion I came to, you know, and like when I went and met with Max Testa about my cramping, you know, he told me that basically I need to spend more time riding in zone 2. So, you know, my type 1 muscles become stronger and I can do more work with my type 1 type muscles. And, you know, my type 2 muscles, which I'm naturally kind of gifted with, you know, I just need to be more judicious using them and save them for the times when I can't spin up something. Because there are some times...
Yeah, there's just you have to play that card sometimes.
Right? You know, but those muscles are fine for about an hour, you know, or mm-hmm. or 30 minutes or whatever. You know, as long as I'm not using them before I really need them and use them when I do, I think I'll be better off. You know, another thing I just kind of want to throw out there that I learned that's interesting is another one of the differences between pros and amateurs is their pedaling techniques. And when an amateur pedals, like they'll have more force at one given point of their pedal stroke than a pro would.
Thinking about the pedal stroke as a circle at 2 o'clock, they'll have more than something.
Right, yeah. Like. Whereas a pro is able to kind of disperse that power throughout more of the pedal stroke.
This is the theory behind oval chainrings, by the way. Right, that it's smoothing that curve. So it's like you're getting more consistent power delivery, right?
Well, no, not necessarily, because the place where the oval's bigger is where you're naturally more powerful.
Oh, so it's supposed to accentuate.
So it kind of accentuates where you're naturally more powerful.
I've heard both, and I guess it probably depends on where you're clocking it too.
Yeah, you know, like an amateur cyclist is naturally good at putting a lot of power at like 3 o'clock down.
Yeah. Like you hear on the rollers, like an amateur versus a pro, like mm-hmm. versus with like a more consistent, I won't make that noise again because that's obnoxious, but like, you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. You know, whereas like the pro cyclist is going to start like at 12 o'clock, pushing forward, mm-hmm. pushing down all the way until 6 o'clock and putting a more even amount of pressure throughout that whole half circle of the pedal stroke.
Right. And then whereas, the other leg does it, it kind of like evens it out exactly.
And on each pedal stroke, the amateur is going to have a higher peak torque at some
relative to the amount of power they're putting out in total, right?
Overall.
Just, yeah.
You know, overall, if the overall wattage was the same.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the amateur is going to have a higher peak torque on each pedal stroke, right. Whereas the pro is just going to be putting more power throughout more of the pedal stroke. And then, you know, and then obviously you want to lift up the, unweight the leg on the way up. And then, so the goal is really to be putting down two perfect half circles that just meet in the middle. And so ultimately you're delivering a smooth amount of torque throughout, or a smoother amount of torque throughout the whole pedal stroke. And so when that amateur is putting that extreme amount of pressure right at 3 o'clock, they're more likely recruiting, you know, type 2A and 2X muscles at that point, where the pro is going to be able to use more type 1 throughout that larger pedal stroke. If that, does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, so really pedal technique is an important part. And in fact, I almost think that's something we should worry more about than how fast we're pedaling or not. Because really, if I had to sum up what cadence is optimal, it's honestly whatever feels best, you know, whatever you're able to produce.
Yeah, what cadence is optimal is whatever cadence is optimal, you know.
Yeah. You know, like if someone tells you to pedal at 100 RPM, that's probably not going to feel very optimal, and you're probably going to want to naturally slow down. You know, and if you're on a, like if you're climbing a hill and you don't have the right gearing, you're going to know, because you're going to want, your thumb's going to be going to shift and you can't, you've run out of gears. So, you know, that cadence isn't optimal, you know? So like I said, it's important, but naturally we, you know, an experienced cyclist is going to gravitate towards the Goldilocks cadence, you know, and there's a too low and there's a too high, but it's something that I think we kind of do naturally. We really don't have to stress out too much about it, you know, and as we get better, we might gravitate towards, you know, towards a faster cadence, but that just kind of happens naturally. And for me personally, really the, you know, if I can develop my type one muscle capabilities better and utilize those more throughout the race. And like you said, you know, kind of use my, you know, use the really low cadence, high force type efforts judiciously.
That's the word of the podcast, by the way.
Judiciously.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know. Get me off the ladder.
What else,
Joe,
is there to say? Yeah. Other than the meta observation that we literally just did an hour long podcast
about spinning our legs
to pedal. Like, I think maybe just take yourself out of the cycling bubble for a second and think about how insanely funny it is that not only do we have a podcast about like cycling, we literally just did an episode about how fast to pedal. Rethink every choice you've ever made.
And the whole conclusion was like,
I don't know,
pedal as fast as you want to pedal.
We should at least give you like a pedal faster or something, right? Gosh, I'm glad people don't pay us. Like, I'd feel really bad about that. Yeah, there you go. There's a Zen take on, I'm going to call this a judiciously Zen take on cadence. Is that a good title?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks you guys for listening.
Maybe we need more guests. I think guests are better.
Maybe. All right, guys. Well, everybody ride safe this week. Stay healthy, and we will talk to you soon.